Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Hello, and thank you for downloading and listening to the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Kling Behind the Scenes. Today's episode features a new segment where we dive into Albertson's first earnings call ever since becoming a public company back in late June. We're not only going to check out the earnings call for the numbers. In fact, the numbers very much secondary to what we're going to talk about because we really get one of the first looks inside some of Albertson's initiatives and some of the things that they've got going on over the last 6 months. We'll have a looking ahead segment diving into pet retail and our interview guest, the fantastic Megan Martindale. She's the global head of retail research at CBRE, and she will look into CBRE's recent U.S. Retail Holiday Trends Guide that came out. We'll discuss a little bit about how the whole buy online, pickup in store dynamic has changed retail real estate, and we'll also talk about how retailers with a brick and mortar presence and shopping centers are working to keep everything safe while continuing to keep everything as a unique and valued experience for the customer. So it's a great interview. It's always a fun time having Megan on the show, and we're glad she's able to join us today. Again, you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Apple Podcasts, we're on Amazon's podcast platform, Google's podcast platform, as well as Spotify, all the big ones, wherever you access podcasts. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. I am actually in Spokane, Washington, as I record this, and got some pictures up on Instagram of some of the downtown retail in Spokane. We'll have some pictures coming up next week from the Hamilton, Montana Kmart as well. So a couple of reasons there to subscribe to our Instagram channel if you don't already. So as we mentioned, we lead with Albertsons, whose first earnings call since becoming publicly traded back in June did take place on Tuesday of this week. We actually had a listener reach out to us because we put out a Wednesday podcast where we talked about the Container Store in our news segment. The listener was wondering why we covered the Container Store and not Albertsons in Wednesday's podcast. Well, we wanted to give Albertsons their due this weekend, so we were kind of saving them for the weekend podcast, as it were. Even before the earnings release, Albertsons had been turning some heads. They'd been named the Supermarket News Retailer of the Year in late August, and really when we talk about Albertsons, it's not a matter of, hey, are they blowing other people out of the water? It's a matter of how quickly can they catch up to their competitors, because they had a period of time, about 4 to 5 years, where they lost some market share to Kroger, lost some market share to Walmart. And granted, some of the markets they exist in aren't the same markets as, say, Walmart is big in or Kroger is big in. But at the same time, when you look at the numbers, you look at some of the initiatives running a little bit behind, and it's really a matter of how quickly CEO Vivek Sankaran and company can catch up to them while continuing to remain profitable and operational. And signs were good to this point in the year, at least, that they were able to navigate the pandemic buying period adeptly back in March and April, while ensuring planned store updates as well went somewhat according to schedule. So Albertsons has been a positive retailer, I think, if you look at this year as a whole. By the way, we should be able to do this with another grocer soon. News broke this week that Southeastern Grocers is indeed moving forward with their IPO as well. Always excited to have more retailers to talk about, because even though we're not as interested in the stock market numbers and the like, oftentimes when retailers are publicly traded, that's the only time we really get a lot of good information from the CEOs, from the CFOs, from the leadership group on earnings calls. Now, as with their large grocery brethren, back to Albertsons now, they're still to get a very diverse store base. Not only do they have a number of banners, we've talked about Pavilions and Safeway and United and, of course, Albertsons themselves, but their acquisition of Safeway several years ago meant picking up a number of stores that were older in composition and in bad need of updates compared with some of their Albertsons stores. The integration with Safeway, just as a little background, it took the company until the middle portion of last year to complete, and they've been able to slowly modernize some of these stores in larger markets. They completed 132 remodels, for example, in the second quarter alone. However, it remains to be seen the extent to which smaller market Safeways will be updated. Currently, only half of the total store base has been remodeled since 2015, but they do continue to remodel about 10% of their store base annually. That store base, by the way, sits at just over 2,250 locations. And if you live in the Mountain West or along the West Coast, you are used to seeing in rural areas these Safeways that are very small in size, oftentimes no more than 15,000 square feet. And the signage hasn't been updated for 20 years. The outdoor signage certainly hasn't been updated for about 20 years. There's no self-checkouts and so forth. And so really what Albertsons is having to do is kind of catch up, once again, playing catch up here a little bit, because Albertsons store banner, you could argue that many of their stores needed a remodel, but for the most part, they were in larger markets and had a larger store footprint already. And there are many Safeway stores in the western portion of the United States that are older. They date back to the 50s and 60s and just haven't been remodeled over that time. But I digress. Let's get to the numbers really quickly, and then we'll get to some of the initiatives for Albertsons. As we've come to expect with grocers, comp store sales, or what Albertsons calls identical store sales, those were up 13.8% year over year, so second quarter over second quarter. This is roughly in line with what Kroger saw in their most recent quarter with a 14.6% identical sales gain excluding fuel. So once again, trailing just a little bit behind Kroger. And, you know, you look at some of the past, although this is Albertsons' first earnings call since going public in June, they've been pretty good about releasing identical sales numbers, at least for a private company. And historically, they've lagged about a percentage point or two behind Kroger. And that's exactly what we see for each company's most recent quarter. It is important to note that Albertsons' quarters are shifted about 1 month later in the year, so there might be some impacts from that as well when comparing to Kroger. But fuel impacts, just like they did for Kroger, reared their head for Albertsons as well. Albertsons' overall revenue was up 11.2%. You compare that to the 13.8% gain in comps, it's not as though they closed a ton of stores during the quarter. A lot of that is fuel related. Again, they have over 1,500 fuel locations at this point. So with fuel sales going down on the whole, that's obviously impacted fuel revenue. And of course, the cost of fuel fairly low as we speak. Now, the gain in revenue for Albertsons, that 11.2% gain in revenue overall, did result in adjusted earnings per share of 60 cents versus 17 cents in last year's second quarter. This beat analyst expectations by a solid 34 cents. Now, adjustments here, when we talk adjusted earnings per share, include accounting for numerous sale leaseback transactions that took place in early 2019. So when we talk about 17 cents in last year's second quarter, that was adjusted to kind of take those out of the equation. Now, based on our own research, a few of those transactions are still trickling in, although not at the same rate as in 2019. You see a few of them on the market every now and again, but not the full flushes as what you were seeing early portions of last year. Now, grocery-anchored centers, just from a real estate perspective, and grocers in general, have been hotter commodities on the commercial real estate market since, of course, the pandemic began, although demand for them had been ramping up even prior to the pandemic, really since about 2018. So this allowed Albertsons to capture a higher price for their stores and kind of cash in a little bit more than they would have in maybe 2016 or 2017. Also, there's the whole saying about cap rates in commercial real estate being indexed to interest rates. So as interest rates have gone down recently, that's meant cap rates have gone down, meaning Albertsons is capturing a larger ultimate price for their sales on those sale leasebacks. But the digital sales, as we talk about those remain strong for Albertsons. Their platform is a little less mature than Kroger's ClickList and Walmart's various options. They did see a 243% increase in digital sales in their second quarter over last year's second quarter. And this follows up a 276% gain from the first quarter. So maybe not necessarily fewer people are shopping, but you've seen growth decrease a little bit, but still massive growth in digital sales. People are still very much using the services, even though the reasons for doing so for Albertsons may have shifted. As we talked about in Wednesday's show, some consumers still list safety as a primary reason for buy online, pick up in store, and curbside, but many are now leveraging these services out of convenience or the cost savings even versus delivery. So the reason for using this has changed as people now a little bit more comfortable going to the store, wearing masks with some of the social distancing programs that the grocers have in place. Albertsons' curbside program, by the way, it was a main topic on the call and is called Drive Up and Go. Kind of on the nose there as far as the branding for that program, but they've seen momentum surrounding not just that platform, but also customer engagement. And this is something that'll tie into our interview later on in the show. Megan Martindale addresses this, but Albertsons is seeing habits in line with the general retail shopper. Those who leverage curbside with Albertsons are increasing their household spending with the company overall. Now, whether this is as a result of increased basket size, something Albertsons also sees in curbside offerings, by the way, or simply just increasing customers' likelihood of shopping at Albertsons family of brands. In other words, Albertsons capturing more share of wallet because of those curbside services. Time will tell on that, but there's no disputing the raw numbers. We know that if you use Albertsons' digital platform, you shop at Albertsons more often and you buy more. They see a 27% increase in spend with their previously engaged customers, so customers that were already fairly engaged with the company and their brands when they use digital services, so 27% increase there. But it's even more noticeable with their less engaged customers. So customers that hadn't been engaged as much with Albertsons coming into the pandemic, coming into using those digital tools, spend increased 2.7 times, not 2.7%, 2.7 times when using their digital services. And again, that's according to CEO Vivek Sankaran on the call. Now, it's important to note that this Drive Up and Go platform is only now available at about 950 of their stores. They hope to have it in 1,400 stores by the end of the fiscal year. They added 200 stores to the platform in the second quarter. But you look, and again, we talked about over 2,200 stores, you're still only seeing about 40% of their stores or less than 40% of their stores with this Drive Up and Go platform currently. Now, partially as a result of this breakneck expansion that we've seen in curbside recently for Albertsons, again, adding it to about 10% of their store base in the last quarter, Drive Up and Go, or what they call internally Doug, grew in revenue over 10 times year over year. So again, not 10%, not 100%, 10 times year over year. Again, though, you look at Kroger and Walmart's near universal adoption of curbside in their outlets. And again, it's a matter of playing catch up for Albertsons. Now, you can't fault Vivek Sankaran and company for having to play catch up at this point, because again, he's been the one, along with his leadership team, that's been driving this change. And it's been very noticeable change over the last couple of years. So you can't begrudge them that, but it is a circumstance where you just have to keep this in mind that, hey, they're still playing from behind a little bit in this long game. Now, long term, Albertsons increased their aim for curbside rollouts. They want integration in 1,800 stores by the end of fiscal 2021. So close to 80 to 85% of their stores, an increase in about 200 stores from their original plans. Now, outside of all the talk surrounding digital, and digital, of course, dominated the call comments, dominated the analyst Q&A, along with EBITDA, which was a topic of conversation a lot of analysts wanted to ask. It was about margins and that type of thing. But Sankaran did notice some interesting trends surrounding their business. We've talked before on the podcast about how more grocery customers are buying fresh produce than ever during the pandemic. Albertsons, meanwhile, in recent years, has attempted to make additional investments towards their fresh assortments, produce and otherwise. And those two things combined to make for some positive comps in a number of their categories. Obviously, produce was a leader among them, but the chief among these categories, and a surprise to us, was seafood. Seafood sales at Albertsons were up 46% across all their banners versus last year's second quarter. So that's really interesting, the fact that they have made some investments in this category, but they've seen sales really pop overall. They've seen the usual strength in produce, as all retailers have since March, but they also noted, although not in the fresh category, that flour sales were up 20% year over year. So in case you're wondering, the sourdough baking craze is very much for real. A lot more flour flying off the shelves at Albertsons stores. Meanwhile, what they call their lifestyle brands, or organic and natural private labels for everyone else, they saw growth in line with overall store comps at just above 13%. They launched 39 new SKUs in those categories during the quarter. So basically, even with everything else there, but part of their fresh initiatives include ready-to-eat and ready-to-heat or cook foods. And stop me if you've heard this before. This is something Albertsons has tried before. They've rolled it back. Well, they revamped the program a little bit, and in their United division, which is mostly in Texas, they launched these initiatives in 60 stores with 340 unique offerings. It went so well, they plan to expand this to 4 more store divisions in the next few months, so keep an eye on those for maybe an Albertsons store near you. Adding additional meal options to that, they want about 380 unique offerings, and that's given how well it was received in Texas. It went really well in Texas, and Texas is a market that seems to be conducive to this type of thing. HEB, you'll recall, especially early on in the pandemic, ready-to-eat, ready-to-heat meals were flying off the shelves at HEB and other stores in Texas. So Texas is probably a good market to try this out. And when we talk about the United brand, United has always been known for some of the fresher offerings. I lived in Texas for a portion of my life in a market where United was a big deal there. And United was by far and away perceived as the best grocery store. You would get the freshest produce, the freshest meat, so on and so forth. It was branded really well and had a massive following there locally where I was at. Albertsons, meanwhile, was treated as kind of the redheaded stepchild, if you will, of the grocery store market in that particular area. So when Albertsons purchased United, and this is something we actually had a past interview guest talk about a couple of years ago, it was a big transition for Albertsons to try and convince people that they weren't going to destroy the United brand, that they weren't going to destroy the United label. So bring all of that back to this trial here with, again, some ready-to-eat, ready-to-heat, or ready-to-cook foods, trying that out in United. Again, that's a great brand because that's a brand perceived in such a way by Texas residents or by a lot of Texas residents that that's where they're going to be picking up some of those products because they have faith in some of that freshness that United has. Now, it's not just food for human consumption driving growth. It's pet food as well and pet products. As expected, with people making fewer store trips, the pet category was up for Albertsons as well. Their private label signature pet products saw growth of 15% quarter over quarter. And finally, they noted their front end remodeling that they've been doing of late will continue in the near future and will continue at previously planned clips. They're on track to launch self-checkout to an additional 481 stores throughout the country in total this year after launching self-checkout in a good chunk of their store population last year. This was really something where we felt like Albertsons was behind, especially in Safeway stores. There were a lot of Safeway stores in big markets that did not have self-checkout options. They expanded those options. They're looking to have around 1,600 of their stores with self-checkout features by the end of this fiscal year. Again, when you look as a percentage of stores behind Walmart, behind Kroger, but progress is being made and you have to applaud leadership for that. With this update in front-end technology, by the way, they are updating some back-end technology as well. They've installed a new supply chain mechanism in 800 stores and the leadership of the company claims this has reduced excess inventory in these stores, which is always good. But here's the key. It's also allowed for over 30,000 hours of human capital to be reallocated to other resources within the stores themselves. And I feel like that is a super important aspect in a time where basically it's all hands on deck for retailers. They're trying to make ends meet with the employment that they've got. They can't hire fast enough in some cases. Getting that human capital freed up by not tinkering around with inventory and allowing them to do some other things within the store, that's a major plus for Albertsons going forward. And I feel like that cannot be underestimated as a benefit of some of these new platforms they have on the back end. So overall, I think if you were to sum this earnings call up, obviously a massive beat in comparison to Wall Street expectations. They did release expectations for the rest of the year as far as earnings per share. Those came out, again, about 10 to 20% ahead of most Wall Street estimates. So good on that front. But I think the overall summation of this is that they are catching up in a hurry to the likes of Kroger and Walmart. And that's a good thing for Albertsons, the newly public company. And I think they're setting themselves up for a really nice, perhaps pleasantly surprising back end of this fiscal year. So after this break, we're going to talk to Megan Martindale of CBRE, the Global Head of Retail Research. She's going to discuss their U.S. Retail Holiday Trends Guide, some dovetailing with that first story that we talked about, especially in terms of buy online, pickup in store, especially in terms of curbside, and what some shopping centers are doing to make sure that their setup is conducive to those services for retailers. We continue our interview series discussing holiday projections, and in today's episode, we turn to kind of a real estate lens through which to view the holiday season. We're pleased to be joined once again by Megan Martindale, the Global Head of Retail Research at CBRE. CBRE, by the way, recently released their 2020 U.S. Retail Holiday Trends Guide, and we'll discuss some of the key points of the guide today. Megan, welcome back to the podcast.
Great. Thank you so much for having me back.
So to begin with, I think a lot of people that are familiar with retail certainly know CBRE is a massive real estate firm there in terms of servicing CRE, but you're also a very large research firm, and a lot of what CBRE has to do is in terms of research. I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of background just to the extent and the breadth of the research that you do at CBRE.
Absolutely. So I am the global head of retail research, and my job is really twofold. I work with my team on all of the national U.S. level retail research output. So our thought leadership, all of our data reports, quarterly reports, any research periodicals that we produce on the national level. And then I am also working in conjunction with our global teams throughout EMEA, APAC, and the broader Americas on all of our global retail thought leadership and research output, you know, especially as the last several years where we've seen just this explosion in cross-border retail. It's becoming a more important part of the conversation than ever, even this year with some of the disruption and trends back to localization.
So that gives us a little bit of a background through which to kind of paint this holiday trends guide. And let's start with kind of the top line of it. What's CBRE's expectation as far as overall holiday retail sales growth this year?
Yeah, so we forecasted early because and we'll talk about this, but we're seeing an earlier start than ever to the holiday sales season. And, you know, we were in sort of a tough position of forecasting at a time when there's just still a lot of uncertainty, you know, in terms of the virus hotspots and the spikes and what's happening with the economy, et cetera. So we have basically put our forecast together saying that we'll see moderated growth in overall retail sales over last year. We're forecasting that we'll probably only be upwards to about 2% in total retail sales. A lot of the brick and mortar retailers that we talk to, especially on the mall side, are expecting their physical store sales could even be down this holiday season. But of course, we're still seeing this explosive growth, you know, with e-commerce, that we're going to have this kind of second surge through holidays. So that will offset some of the potential sales declines in the brick and mortar side of retail.
Let's go ahead and talk about that second surge, because it was a main topic of conversation in the holiday trends guide. We've heard a lot about the cadence of holiday sales, maybe some of it being pushed earlier. Sales might be more spread out. What are some of the things that you've noticed about how retailers and consumers are approaching the entirety of the holiday season and when those sales will trickle in exactly?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the things to keep in mind and even to point out for our holiday sales prediction is that we typically compare holiday retail sales year over year for November and December. And to your point, this year we're seeing the holiday sales and promotional season pulled forward all the way into October for a couple different reasons. One being just the safety aspect. You know, we're still obviously living with the pandemic and seeing these hotspots. So to avoid, you know, the crowds that typically gather for doorbuster sales and, you know, in an era of social distancing, we're seeing retailers spread out a lot of those sales and promotions longer through November and December and even coming as far forward into October. And then that's also for inventory management and availability. So they have a better chance of managing the supply chain. You know, we saw in that surge in April with e-com, you know, there was so much supply chain strain and limited product availability that it hurt some of the e-com sales. And so a lot of retailers are gearing up and trying to avoid that for the season by elongating that promotional season. So when we look at holiday sales this year and we forecast for sales, you know, we're going to see sales that typically are consigned to November and December pulled into October. And when we did our forecast, just to be very clear, you know, we benchmarked that against the growth of 2019 for November and December. But really, in actuality, when we come back to reconciling holiday sales, you know, we're basically going to look at a sales season that basically covered the entire fourth quarter, October, November, and December this year. So it's a little hard to compare apples to apples because we're seeing just such a big shift in that pull forward. But really, you're going to have a lot of the sales picked up this month. You know, it really kind of started to kick off as early as last week.
And so with that spreading out of sales, I think retailers are approaching Thanksgiving and Black Friday differently, certainly. You mentioned in the report, of course, that several retailers are just saying, hey, we're going to close Thanksgiving, we're throwing in the towel, which is really a reversal of what we saw 15 to 20 years ago, where more retailers were opening Thanksgiving. What are some things you're noticing about how retailers are approaching that Thanksgiving to Cyber Monday period of time?
Yeah, it's interesting because to your point, this has been evolving, you know, the last several years, both with the start of starting to open earlier on Thanksgiving. And then if you fast forwarded last year in 2019, we already started to see the shift in that traditional 5-day shopping period of Thanksgiving through Cyber Monday. And, you know, the idea of the Black Friday sales has been losing some relevance. The retailers have been less dependent on that really traditional Black Friday surge in sales. And part of that is with Cyber Monday. But even if you look at last year, you saw Black Friday deals and Cyber Monday deals extended for a whole week. You know, so we started to see a sort of a minor elongation of some of those promotions. This year, though, we're seeing that spread out a lot more, as I said. So instead of, you know, looking at sales that are just a Black Friday deal or just a Cyber Monday deal, we're seeing a lot more promotions from a lot of different retailers, e-commerce retailers and brick and mortar with an e-com platform. And they're spreading them out longer through November, through, you know, first part of December. But, and as I mentioned, you know, some are even pulling those as far forward as to say we're having early Black Friday deals in October, just to kind of get away from that surge on that one holiday weekend. And, you know, the big question is, well, does that stick going forward? Is this just specific to pandemic era because of supply chain and social distancing and the, you know, the issues that I mentioned? But again, this is kind of another trend that I think accelerated to, couldn't have even imagined, you know, last year, just because we're in this sort of hopefully an anomaly year of COVID. But I do think some of these trends in spreading out the promotion, spreading out what is offered both in the store and online versus being specific to a store sale or specific to an online sale, I think some of that sticks going forward and we'll start to see some of those trends carry on next year, you know, even when we're coming out of pandemic crisis.
Speaking of those particular trends, I think the topic that's been on everyone's minds is what share e-commerce will have in terms of overall holiday sales. And looking at all the prognostications and consumer surveys that are out there, we've seen numbers anywhere between 15% and some consumer surveys saying as high as 70%, which if that happens, the supply chain probably just all collapses on itself. But what is CBRE's data indicating on this front as far as e-commerce share?
Yeah, so we're kind of somewhat in the middle, I would say. If you look at the growth over 2019, we're predicting 40%. Growth in e-commerce sales this holiday season, and that would put us at about a 32% penetration rate for holiday. But once again, you know, just to we were only looking at November and December to compare that to 2019. So when we have the gift of hindsight here in January and we're reconciling sales, we will actually have to pull in October sales to that. And, you know, I think depending on how much of a surge we saw last week through Prime Day, the competing sales, and how much e-commerce transactions we see here the next 10 days to the end of the month, we could even see those numbers grow.
Now, that being said, more digital sales doesn't necessarily mean more shipped directly to home, because as we've seen, and as you and I talked about the last time you were on the show, we're seeing a lot of retailers beginning to push curbside, push buy online, pick up in store. What is CBRE seeing as far as trends towards retailers attempting to adjust to what could be an exponential increase in demand for those channels, not just in terms of their in-store goings on, but also in terms of their real estate footprint?
Yeah, you know, and it's a challenge to manage it all. I mean, if you look at digital sales that are shipped to the consumer, that is largely an unprofitable model for retailers. So, of course, we had seen, you know, pre-COVID, the push to buy online, pick up in store, and retailers love that because you tend to get a higher conversion rate when people come in to pick up their product. And then, of course, during 2020, you know, it all got pushed to largely curbside, and we will absolutely continue to see that. I mean, curbside is here to stay. part of the challenge is just the, literally the operational structure of that. Depending if you're a retailer or you're a shopping center owner, we're really seeing people gear up and staff and deal with everything from traffic control and directional signage and, you know, all of just the technical details in implementing the curbside, given that we're expecting to see, even if traffic is down from last holiday, you're still going to see that holiday surge in traffic and shopping and picking up those packages. So, you know, spreading out the sales to avoid kind of those, you know, really sort of time-specific doorbusters we talked about, that certainly helps. But we're seeing a lot of retailers and shopping center owners alike hire additional staff, specifically as runners, to help facilitate the curbside pickup so you're not taxing some of the retail associates and the people working in the stores. We're seeing a lot of mall and shopping center owners working collectively with their retailers to offer a more centralized pickup location that the mall property management team and operations team will help facilitate, you know, versus you having all of these independent retailers trying to offer curbside, you know, at their door. It can be kind of a problem in terms of circulation and traffic control, especially as we're seeing some of the reduced capacities and social distancing. So I think it's really all hands on deck with the retailers, and if they're a retailer in a shopping center or a mall environment, working with the owners and, you know, the mall team there to really just make sure that that is as efficient, as controlled as possible to handle that anticipated surge in traffic.
You mentioned retailers that are in shopping centers, that are in these malls. Basically, everything that we had heard over the last 3 years prior to the pandemic was how important experiential retail was, how important the experience was to the consumer. Well, a lot of that, out of necessity, has changed due to the pandemic. What are some changes that you're seeing in terms of shopping centers, in terms of malls, how they're trying to maybe replicate some of those experiential things for the consumer and maintain that top of mind awareness for the customer?
Yeah, well, we've definitely seen how we define experience change this year. I mean, pre-COVID, it was experiential was all around engagement and discovery and lingering and cross-shopping and, you know, all of these great attributes that retailers and mall owners alike were implementing at their properties to really differentiate the store or the mall. And now, you know, experience has taken on a whole new meaning this year where it's about safety and convenience and value and are my products available to pick up on time and, you know, were the actual products themselves available or were there substitutions? You know, we've had this completely redefinition, redefining moment of what experience means. And we're seeing that, you know, carry over into just how the stores and some of the shopping center owners are operating during the holiday season. And I think the big key here is that, you know, retailers and mall owners are trying to find that really delicate balance of preserving the traditions and the festivities of the shopping season, especially, you know, after such a difficult year when people kind of need that, you know, holiday spirit here at the last quarter. But it's also balancing that with the safety, with the convenience, with that accessibility that's become so paramount this year.
I'm going to go a little bit off the map in terms of outside maybe the retail holiday trends guide this year. But the last time we talked was, you know, shortly after the onset of the pandemic. We were talking a little bit about adjustments that certain shopping center and mall owners and operators were making in an attempt to basically meet customers and meet businesses, retailers, where they were at. What are some of the big things as you look back at the last 7 months or so, what are some of the big things that real estate operators have learned in those terms?
Wow, there's a long list, that's for sure. And, you know, I will say there's a lot of sort of variations by region, just because we saw different parts of the country hit at much different rates by the virus in terms of the depth of the virus, the severity of it, sort of when they started coming out of it, and then if they've gone into a second wave. The other issue or the other component to that is it's varied a lot by product type, you know, so some of the operational challenges and lessons learned, you know, in the malls are very different than the grocery anchored, for instance. I would say that if I completely oversimplified all the nuances, both regionally and then by product type, you know, it's obviously number one been about safety. And we have seen consumers come back into the stores as soon as they start reopening. We've seen that pent-up demand, you know, after the closures started to be released. And so we know that the consumers want to come back into the environment. So it's really been about knowing that, you know, place still matters and the retail physical stores still matters. Not everything has migrated online, and it, in my opinion, it won't. But the places that people used to love to be for that experiential component are now very much the places that they trust. Is this going to be a safe environment for me to shop? Is it even, you know, the retailer and the shopping center owners making sure their employees are safe, not just about the consumers, but wanting that comfort level that they're keeping, doing everything they can to keep their employees safe. So I definitely think there's a component to that. One of the really creative trends that we're seeing this year for holiday 2020 is this idea of in and out shopping. So we're seeing retailers and shopping center owners really creatively using space outside the retail stores. So if you're an open air shopping center or a freestanding retailer, you can utilize parking fields and sidewalks and, you know, any common areas for additional selling space, displays, any kind of services. If you're a mall owner, we're seeing a lot of this pushed into the common areas or even other vacant retailer spaces. And I think some of the best examples really come from the retailers themselves, especially when you're looking at a smaller store. So not so much on the big box retailer side, but if I'm a specialty tenant, an accessory, the shoe store, an apparel tenant, and I am working with limited capacities and social distancing restrictions this holiday season, one of the really creative things that they're implementing is the idea that everything that is surrounding product engagement is reserved for the in-store experience, but they're pushing outside of the stores, you know, into the common areas, into other retail spaces, anything that's non-product related. So it's the actual purchase, gift wrapping, gift card sales, maybe returns. And that's really to just preserve that in-store experience purely for the shopping, the product engagement, that, you know, gift selection, and that interaction, you know, between the store staff and the consumer itself, where we're seeing some of the very critical and key but ancillary uses that don't necessarily have to take place in the physical store pushed to the exterior. And one of the trends that we've seen with consumers, but it's had a direct impact on just the operations side, is we're seeing these consolidated shopping trips where we're seeing a much higher conversion rate. When consumers come back to shop physical retail, they're buying more, their basket sizes are up, but they're shopping less. The traffic is down. And, you know, retailers and the shopping center owners have really had to adapt to that. You know, what does that mean for how many retailers they're cross-shopping? How many retailers of mine are even open? How are we doing the curbside? How are we making this environment safe, convenient, and accessible, knowing that this shopper is coming to us less, but they're coming with a much more intentional, sort of purposeful reason to shop, and they're going to come get everything that they need, you know, for that week or that month, and we need to make sure that we make it the best shopping experience that we possibly can.
Some great insight there, and I wanted to wrap up by kind of circling back to the Holiday Trends Guide from this year. As you and your team were putting together the Trends Guide, I know you're in the research realm day in, day out. Was there any particular number or any particular facet of something that really jumped off the page at you, or maybe not so much caught you off guard, but maybe surprised you a little bit?
You know, I will tell you, it's not so much around the holiday report, but leading into the holiday report, we just got our consumer sentiment and retail sales for September, and they were very strong. And so, you know, we were very deliberate and very careful in making our holiday forecasts without a lot of data and with a lot of uncertainty. So it was, we wanted to put numbers out there that we feel like we could really stand behind, where we're, you know, cautiously optimistic, but also realistic just in terms of some of the economic headwinds that are ongoing, the virus spiking, et cetera. But I will tell you that, you know, just last Friday when we got these September numbers, it put us in a much stronger position as far as consumer spending and consumer sentiment, even given everything going on with the economy and the virus and the election and everything else. It was much stronger than I even expected. So that gave me sort of a lot of hope for the holiday season, knowing that the consumer was back out spending. You know, we saw employment starting to improve in some sectors. Sentiment was rising, you know, and I think that puts us on a much stronger footing than honestly I was expecting for September as we head into the holiday season officially kicking off in October this year.
Well, that sounds like it could be great news for retailers. Well, we love retail data and we love commercial real estate. Anytime we can combine them, we enjoy doing it. So thank you, Megan, for joining us once again on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, once again, we thank Megan for joining us. As always, there's a link to the CBRE U.S. Retail Holiday Trends Guide if you want to check it out in our show notes. It's always great to have her on the show. Again, as I mentioned at the end of the interview, we love talking real estate, we love talking retail data, and it's great when those two worlds combine. Now, as far as our looking ahead story for this week, I wanted to go into the pet supplies space and the pet retail space. Petbusiness.com, fantastic place, and if you're interested in retail, I highly recommend checking it out. There's a lot of product information on there, but there's some good information about retailers as well, and they've got kind of the inside line to a lot of pet store retailers. Keep in mind, you know, PetSmart, Petco, Pet Supplies Plus, these are private companies that we don't hear a lot from. So it's important to have outlets like these that are covering this particular retail segment. And in this circumstance, we've known for a little bit that Petco has attempted to kind of move up and accelerate a rebrand a little bit. Not that they're changing their name, but they've altered their logo somewhat and they've added the tagline, the health and wellness company. And that's something that they really want to drive home. They're planning a major marketing campaign in 2021 to talk mostly about pet health and wellness. And their goal here, in the words of CEO Ron Coughlin, is to be kind of that pet store combination between Whole Foods and CVS. They're opening up a lot of brick and mortar pharmacies within their particular locations. That's a good thing, but that's something that, you know, PetSmart already has with Banfield Animal Hospital and the like. The differentiation is that they are slowly making over their product assortment to where there's a number of things that are seen as maybe harmful to pets. For example, they banned the selling of shock collars from their product assortment. They've eliminated dog and cat food and treats with any artificial colors, flavors, or preservatives as well. They're trying to move more into that natural food space. And this is all going to be capped off with this 2021 ad campaign. Now, the reason I'm looking ahead to this story is, can Petco leverage this to properly become maybe the player in this space that's differentiated from all of the others? Because now when I see a Petco, when I drive by a Petco, to me, it's tantamount to PetSmart. Even the logos have the same color. The logos look not necessarily similar, but when you look from afar, you know, hey, that's a big box pet store and whatever, they're all the same. So if Petco can complete this reimaging, if you will, they can drive home that health and wellness company tagline. Does that put them on the inside track in terms of the brick and mortar pet store industry? We've talked about how well Chewy has been doing certainly of late, but I think there's a big demand for brick and mortar pet stores still, because as long as you're not getting 1 hour delivery from Chewy, there's going to be circumstances where you run out of food, where you need something last minute, or you need veterinary help for your pet. And Petco is aiming to be the solution, but not only the solution, the natural solution. And we've talked about it on the show before. We've had interview guests talk about this before, where people are less likely to buy into private labels or cheaper products for their pets than they would for their own kids. You're looking at a circumstance where no one wants to be put in a situation where they're thinking to themselves, I don't want to go to that store because that is not the Whole Foods for pets. I need to be going to the Whole Foods or to the Sprouts or what have you for pets, because my pet is that important to me. And I think that's a really interesting angle to take. I think it's a smart angle to take, but I'm anxious to see exactly how this reimaging works for Petco. We'll only know probably in late 2021 or early 2022 how it's going, but really anxious to see some of this reimaging. And again, they've kind of changed up their logo. They've taken away the melded together dog and cat in their logo. It's a very simple, very clean logo now. So again, very interested to see where this goes. Now, before we sign off, did want to extend our condolences to the family of the former chairman and CEO of Harp's Food Stores in Arkansas. Gerald Harp passed away on October 16th. It's difficult news, certainly, for those that have ever been through Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri. You've probably seen one of these food stores. They are seen in those particular markets as kind of upscale, nicer food stores. There's a focus on local foods as well. It's an employee-owned company, and it's something that's become a little bit of an institution in that area. So it was disappointing, certainly, to hear that he passed away. And again, the company actually recently went through a set of expansion. They bought a number of former Walmart Express locations. Remember when Walmart closed down their Express concepts a few years ago, and Harp's expanded into those. So you're looking at a number of Harp's outlets now, 114 in all, in an area of the country that otherwise would be dominated pretty much by Walmart. And they operate right in Walmart's backyard in Northwest Arkansas. So I think that's certainly something to applaud the company for. And he will certainly be missed, but we'll think of his retail contributions quite fondly. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. For Leighton Behind the Scenes, I'm Trent. We thank Megan Martindale for joining us here on the podcast. We're looking forward to next week's show, next show coming up on Sunday. We're going to talk to Woody Levin. Woody Levin is from Extend. He's going to talk about extended warranty plans in retail, something that we haven't addressed on the show before. It's an interesting concept. It goes way deeper than you think. So that's going to be an interesting show, and I highly recommend you set up your phone or device to download that. We'll see you 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.